Welcome to Politics and First Sentences. Yes, guys, we're back again. And look, for those that are listening on their podcast, be aware that this is live on Facebook right now. That's right, live. So what's Politics and Four Sentences? It's all for those who love the free markets and free minds. And so tonight, again, we've got some very interesting subjects. Yeah, but look who we got here. We've got David Seymour, the man himself.
G'day, Max. How you going?
Very good. Yeah. Well, you're about to come under the roast of Max Whitehead. Do you think you can cope?
Look, I don't know. Well, I had Paddy Gower on the project last night.
I watched.
So if you're as easy as him, then yes. But I suspect you might be better.
Well, you certainly buffed him last night. I hear he said he was going to stand in Epsom against you.
Well, I hope he does. It'd actually bring a bit of fun to it. But I don't know if he's entirely down with Politics 101.
Well, you certainly proved him a point. Now, tell everybody what you said. His response when he said he was going to stand in Epsom.
Oh, I can't do that. And then I said to him, no, but I tell you what was interesting is he said he was going to stand in Epsom, and I thought it was just a perfect example of a journalist who is not content to report the news, but actually wants to be the news or wants to make the news.
True.
I actually thought it was quite interesting for that reason. And for what it's worth, I just said, well, you know, I can't think of anything that would better help my chance of re-election than Paddy Gower standing against me. So anyway,
improve the intelligence level on both sides of the Tasman. That's where that came from, wasn't it?
Well, that was apparently, people say that was Muldoon, but I've heard it wasn't Muldoon. Maybe someone out there in the comments can tell us who it was, if not Muldoon.
So please do. We give you comments at the bottom. We'd like to know more about that. So if you want to make a comment online now, we'd love to know. So David, I just want to say that your role in Parliament must be absolutely difficult. You're a lone gladiator against 120 professional negotiators, arguers. They're voted by the public to be the best at what they do, and you generally have to stand up for things that none of them agree with. So I've got to say that there's a lot of admiration for you for that. So you must feel very lonely at times in there.
Oh, not at all. Actually, can we just... I will answer that, but I'm just looking at the breaking news here. New Zealand First President resigns after refusing to sign 2019 financial reports for, quote, moral reasons. So there's Lester Gray. He's the president of
moral
New Zealand
reasons.
First.
Gosh.
And, he said he won't sign the party's financial reports because it's for moral reasons. And, of course, Winston Peters is now doing a Jacinda Ardern saying, oh, that's a party matter.
Wow, yeah. That could be financial, all sorts of difficulties. Well, we shouldn't speculate, I guess, but certainly implies that there could be some very, it's almost implying corruption, but we don't want to go there.
Well, we wouldn't want to say that, you know, but
right. But
very interesting development for New Zealand First. So who knows, but I just thought we should get that out as breaking news. No, look, I've never felt lonely in Parliament for two reasons. One is that I know what I believe. You know, I believe in freedom, choice, and personal responsibility. And so if you've got those beliefs, then you're there for a reason other than making friends. So that's made it a bit easier. The other thing that's made it easy is that, of course, everyone says, oh, you're a party of one. Well, it may be true, but it's a bit like an iceberg. You know, I might be the one in Parliament. But if you look at the ACT Party, our board, our membership, our volunteers, we've actually got a fantastic group of people up and down the country. And, I've always taken a lot of support from those people and also in a way from the Epsom electorate because, a lot of people vote for me there, obviously. That's how I got elected. But, just walking around talking to people, going and knocking on doors, I've always found that the people are actually very supportive of me as their representative.
Yeah.
So for all of those reasons, I may have made it look hard from time to time, but it really isn't that difficult.
It just feels that you get attacked a lot more than probably most and criticised a lot more than most, and it just looks hard.
Yeah, but that goes back to having the principles, right? So, I mean, it's not difficult to go along and get along and just say whatever's fashionable at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's all fine. But, if you stand for a principle, then, you find yourself doing things like, taking on the euthanasia or the assisted dying law for 4 years. You know, that campaign's been going 4 years. Because just fundamentally, I think if it's your life and your choice, you shouldn't have to suffer for someone else's morality. Now, there are a group of people out there, it's actually only about 10%, according to the polls, who strongly oppose that notion. So that brings a bit of blowback.
Yeah, that must give you strength because you're actually getting a lot of traction there and a lot of support.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, 70% of New Zealanders actually agree with choice and the other 20% in the middle aren't sure or weakly oppose it. But so that's kind of helpful. Yeah. And again, charter schools, I mean, you know, we believe that education is there primarily for the kids. And if a group of people can set up a better school that takes those kids and those kids' share of the money away from where they have been previously, then that's great for those kids. You know, we're not worried about preserving the provider that those kids don't want to go to. And of course, there's a, you know, there's an education industrial complex, for want of a better term. There's the teacher unions and so on who, of course, you know, they want to preserve the status quo. Well, you know, we stood up for that because it's the right thing to do. And yeah, that gets you some blowback.
So what were you like at school? I mean, you had to, did you stand up for exactly what you did or did you go with the peers? Did you feel that pressure or when you did stand up with it, did you cop, you know, because school kids can be more brutal than adults sometimes.
Oh, a bit of both. I mean, I wasn't, you know, a sort of a total outsider, but I wasn't, you know, sort of running with the cool crowd either. We sort of had our group of friends that were sort of, I guess, second tier in the coolness hierarchy, and we did our own thing a bit. So I wouldn't say I was one or the other. But I remember suddenly taking on my teachers a few times through essays where I thought they were wrong. And what I'd say to kids is that that's a very noble thing to do, but if I had my time again, I'd just write what they want, hold my beliefs, and get the grades.
Yes, I can relate to that too. So I think a lot of people out there be nodding, you're better off just to go with the flow of those things. Look, David, I want to touch on a few things. I'm pleased you brought up some news items because that's where I've been looking today for subject matter for you. So today I want to talk again about a little bit about free speech because there's been some news on that. And also I want to talk about in terms of there's been a high court decision in regards to the free speech thing. So I want to touch on that and what your interpretation is in terms of the decision, because I've got some views as well.
Yep.
And then I see New Zealand First. You've touched on them already, but I was going to bring up, you know, is Shane Jones abusing his position and is Winston Peters buying votes? Those sort of allegations have been rushed around, and I'd be interested to know what your views are on those.
Yeah,
And so there's lots of things we could talk about. And National Party's talking about penalising parents whose kids drop out before the age of 18.
Oh, man.
I think there's a lot of good stuff in that to be come out, and I'd like to hear your views on it. So should we start with the free speech thing and the news breaking out this week?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's been another busy week for free speech. I mean, first of all, you know, meaning people on this podcast, have been a bit critical of some of the university vice chancellors and leaders. Really,
for good reason too.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, look, Jan Thomas at Massey University, you know, wrongly or misrepresented the position of the police to bar Don Brash from speaking at Massey, saying it was health and safety, and she'd contacted the police. And actually, the story wasn't quite like that. Totally wrong, and you know, we were very critical of that. You know, Derek McCormick, the Vice Chancellor of AUT, which they say is a university. So I'm from Auckland, I have to say that. But you know, they received a letter from the Chinese consulate saying, we'd rather you didn't commemorate Tiananmen Square.
Yes.
And he wrote back and said, what a convenience. You know, we happen to not have any rooms available on Queen's Birthday Monday. I mean, AUT is a huge campus. The idea rooms, that there are no free rooms on a public holiday, you've got to be kidding, right? So there's been some really weaselish behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
And downright, in the case of Massey, quite insidious behaviour by university leaders actually acting against free speech. And we've criticised that. But I want to say this week, things are great.
Aren't they?
You know, like, so, I mean, we've got Speak Up for Women, and this is a group of what some people call trans-exclusionary radical feminists. They would just call themselves feminists. And their basic view is that they want to stand up for biological women and say, we have a set of claims and rights that don't apply to people we regard as men claiming to be women. You know, and they say, we want to, you know, changing rooms that are only for biological women. You know, if we want to have a lesbian association, then we want to be able to restrict that to biological women. We're offended by the idea that people we regard as men who are transgender should be able to enter our spaces. And look, obviously, there's a debate about this. I mean, there are some people who will say, I get it, but I authentically feel like I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, and why should I have it rubbed in my face that I'm not really? So I get it. There's a debate that people, I guess, can disagree on. The point is that they should be allowed to have the debate. Massey University have said, we will allow these speakers, Megan Murphy, a Canadian speaker who expresses the views I've just sort of set out from the sort of traditional feminist view, we will allow them to speak. It's a question of free speech, and they're coming under all sorts of pressure.
I believe there's a lot of pressure going on them.
Oh, the rainbow ticks say, oh, you can't have free speech. You know, people expressing views is homophobic. And they say, oh, well, you know, the Action Station, which is sort of a left-wing lobby group that uses petitions quite cleverly, I have to say, you know, they're starting a campaign against Massey.
Well, I hear the threat is that they're going to drop the rainbow tick off.
Oh,
off
yeah, you lose your rainbow tick. And this is really worrying because at first, I thought Rainbow Tick was a really great idea because basically it was a private sort of free market solution where a business could say, you know what, we're a place that is inclusionary and you know, we're going to make people feel, welcome regardless of their sexuality. I thought, what a great idea. It's not forced by government. It's just something that private enterprise
can choose to do. It's like an accreditation, if you like.
Yeah, exactly.
You qualify.
But now, they're actually saying, well, you know, if you have this debate about, you know, gender, then you are not worthy.
Suppressing free speech.
Yeah. And look, I personally think they've got that wrong. I mean, you know, if you were going to have a speaker saying, you know, all people, all, you know, being homosexual is a sin and we're all going to go to hell, you might say, well, hang on a minute. I mean, that's a bit abusive. But, you know, not even being able to have this quite modern debate that a lot of people are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a real shame for Rainbow Tick and Action Station. I mean, who cares? They're just a lefty noise machine. But, Massey for now are holding the line, and good on them.
Isn't it good?
Yeah, and good on Speak Up for Women. Then the next thing is there's
Auckland University.
There's Auckland University. So, again, you've got basically a bunch of dicks. I would wager 50-50 that actually it's
gender discrimination calling them dicks.
Oh, I don't know, but I don't care. I would wager 50-50 it's actually basically satire that some people have gone and put these things that basically say,
oh, this is
we're looking for white brothers to take back our country. Now, you know, obviously, that's stupid. Anybody who knows anything about anything knows that New Zealand has never been and never will be a country that is owned entirely by white people. Even in pre-European times, there were a whole lot of different iwi that would have, you know, claims to quite a different view of who should be in charge and what the world is.
So there's a big call to drag all those posters and advertising down.
Yeah, so it's a demonstrably silly claim. We shouldn't even pay it any attention that, you know, one group of people sort of somehow own New Zealand. You just have to look at your own social networks. You know, me, you, anyone watching this, you think, well, you know, is this country all about one ethnic group of people? Of course it's not. Now, you know, instead of just saying, well, that's pretty stupid, it's gone into this huge thing and people have signed petitions and it's got to be taken down. But what really worries me about it is that there's all these people who, without even thinking about, you know, what the standards of free expression should be, just want it taken down because they don't like it. And I think that to ask the university to act as a censor is a terrible thing. It shows that these people haven't really thought about what the value of academic freedom and free expression. They haven't thought about where the limits of that are. They just think if enough people complain, then someone should be shut up. And Stuart McCutcheon, to his great credit, Stuart's the vice chancellor, has said, look, I find it pretty objectionable. You know, me too. I'm sure most people do. But they haven't actually broken any laws, so we are not going to go around acting as the university censor. And, of course, this has just driven the lovies have just gone berserk, you know. Their brains are exploding. So, finally, this week, we've had two universities come out and say, look, if people aren't breaking the law, if they're not threatening or inciting violence, then people can say objectionable things, and if you don't like it, then you should come up with better ideas, not try and censor everyone, and I think that's great.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had David Cunliffe on a podcast here, and my last words to him, I hope your employment's not affected by this, knowing how Auckland University may have had in the past some sort of, and of course this is perfect for him. He'd be delighted with their stance on this, allowing free speech, allowing some people to stand up and have views without it interfering. And the Vice Chancellor is actually going and almost quoted David when he was on the podcast here, the almost exact words, saying that this is a place, university should be a place of free speech.
Yeah, so old Cunners has come out on the right side of it too. Well, that's really good news, because he had a pretty rough exit from politics, so I'm glad he's standing up for good causes.
We should touch a bit on that, because David spent $200,000, not his own money, but a lot of other people's money, in actually challenging the decision where they... there were two ultra-right-wing speakers coming up from Canada. And
oh, you're talking about David Cumin.
Cumin.
Well, I thought you were David Cunliffe, the former Labour leader. I was like, well, it's great that he's on our side too. Cumin. You mean David Cumin. Yeah.
Cumin, right. Or Cumin, yes. So, yeah, so we're now on the right track. So what he's he was spent a lot of money on this, and the High Court decision came out this week, and it's gone against him. David, have you read the decision? Have you had a look at it?
Look, I haven't read the decision, and given my level of legal training, which is zero, it probably wouldn't make a big difference if I did. But what I do know is that I've read other people's summaries of it, and what I do know, people are good lawyers, and what they've basically said is, because Regional Facilities Auckland is not a public entity, they weren't acting in the public interest. Therefore, they didn't have to consider the Human Rights Act and its protections of freedom of expression when they made the decision. They were just a commercial entity deciding whether or not it would be safe to enter into a contract. So, look, arguably...
Do you think the High Court dodged the hard question? Because it was a blatant question they asked them emphatically.
Yeah. And courts do this all the time. I mean, you remember the case of the kid in Hawke's Bay whose hair was too long for this. Yes. And the court was asked to rule whether a school could actually make a hair rule and whether it was acceptable for kids to be able to wear their hair however they want, or if the school's right to make rules trump that. And the court dodged it by saying, oh, this school's rules weren't written very well, leaving the wider question open. Now, this court appears to have done it again. They've said, well, technically, this wasn't really a public entity. Therefore, we're not going to judge on whether they've violated the right to freedom of expression. So, yeah, the courts are kicked for touch. But eventually, this is going to have to be resolved because, you know, you can't have a person threatening violence, as these guys did, shutting down. And the same thing that happened with this Cardinal Carl Pearce dude at Massey with Don Brash. You know, someone threatens violence, then you don't get to speak. Well, that's the heckler's veto, and
that's right,
you know, it's not a healthy society to have like that.
So, I mean, it's from my perspective, I don't know how you feel about it, but it's a shame that they haven't address that question. And of course, there's a great investment of a lot of money from the people that have had a go at it, and it's a shame that it hasn't got any traction on it.
Yeah,
but well, anyway, it's something we've got to, probably the courts are going to have to deal with one day. And I've actually asked David whether they're going to appeal it.
Yeah, and look, I think the Free Speech Commission Coalition, will be thinking very hard about that.
Whether the case is the right one to take up.
Well, how much will it cost, and can they win, and what exactly are they appealing for?
Yeah. All right, well, should we move on to New Zealand First? Because I think you're very keen to jump into those poor group of politicians. Mm. Talking of poor, there's poor Shane Jones, isn't he? Because he's only got how many billion he's got to
play with? Only a billion each year. I mean, 3 billion in total, but he's got to wait a year to start a new billion. Look, rather than going sort of down the negative track and criticising all the time, how about we put this in a positive frame? Why can't it be the norm that a politician in New Zealand would never, ever think of trying to connect a specific expenditure to a specific group of people with their re-election? You know, like it's not too much to ask that it would just be unthinkable for a politician to go to an award ceremony for a particular industry and say, you guys must vote for me to keep other people's money flowing, because that's what he did. And unfortunately, he did do that. And just to go a little bit negative, the other thing that Shane Jones subsequently did is he said, I'm going to find out who made these comments, or at least reported the comments to the media. I mean, he made the comments to 500 people and he was surprised it got out. I mean, what an idiot. But I'm going to find out from the Overseas Investment Office if they are in keeping with the good character test, having leaked my comments. Now, you know, to say I'm going to use something like the Overseas Investment Office to punish my political opponents, I mean, this is seriously bad stuff. And this is why the Prime Minister needs to be a lot tougher in calling him in, because that's part of the problem with this coalition situation, is that normally the Prime Minister is in charge of all the ministers, but you've got a bunch of ministers who aren't actually answerable to the Prime Minister. I guess they're kind of answerable to their own leader, Winston Peters, but he doesn't really seem to care. So,
which is strange.
Well,
I think he's pulled a few of them in the past, didn't he?
Speaks to his personal ethics. I suspect that there's a bit of a leadership power play going on, and Winston's actually more than happy to let Shane Jones hang himself.
Oh, that's an interesting theory, and that's a possibility as well.
Yep.
You know, on the news tonight as well, just before I was leaving to come here, I see that the moving of the ports of Auckland up north.
Right.
I mean, that is another policy the New Zealand First have got. And there's been, it's what it was saying in the news, that it was becoming more of a reality and it's going to be reviewed more seriously than it was in the past. We're hearing that quite regularly, but I would just wonder if this is another election ploy for the people up north. If you vote right, we might get a port up here.
Well, maybe. I think this was actually a mayoral report. I think this came out of Auckland Council rather than the central government. But I've only read the headlines. I haven't read the whole thing.
Same.
Yeah. So, well, look, I say one thing about it. I don't think in the long term it's viable to have that highly valuable land on the Auckland waterfront used for, basically storing and shipping a whole lot of cars as they're in transit. Second of all, the people that live around that area, some of whom live in Parnell, as part of the Epsom electorate that I represent, are absolutely sick of being on an industrial thoroughfare. And, you know, we got to decide if we want everyone to live in apartments and have inner city living and stuff, then, you know, it helps if they don't have to sweep the diesel dust off their balconies from all the trucks. So there's that conflict between those two lifestyles, and it seems in the long run that land is going to be more and more valuable. You get all the great cities in the world, increasingly they've got ports elsewhere. But the number one reason you can't move it is it's impossible to build anything in New Zealand. You know, I read today that
because of the roads?
Well, it's possible to build roads as well. It's the regulation that's the problem. You know, I read today that the trams in Napier, which Napier had trams a long time ago, were constructed in 6 months. You know, from when they said, let's have trams, what do we need? Okay, put down some tracks, poles, wires, get some trams in. Nope, no problem.
6 months?
Yep.
Tracks, trams on there, and then
yeah,
delivering
and you think
service.
About it. I mean, just think for a moment. Why should it take longer than that?
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, now, the Chinese do show us very well how to build roads and highways.
Well, exactly. And now in Auckland, we're supposed to be getting a tram up Dominion Road, and we can't even get past the planning stage. Now, personally, I think that's great because I think it's a boondoggle and I don't think it's a particularly good idea. And I don't think it will deliver what people expect. But, you know, nevertheless, we could have actually built the tram, decided it didn't work and got rid of it by now if it wasn't so hard to get anything done. And when you talk about moving the ports of Auckland, well, one of the reasons it stays there is it's actually easier to get resource consent to modify an area that's already a port than create a new port somewhere else, say in the Firth of Tees.
David, some of your opposition would say, now look, what we're doing is giving consultation. We're giving the public an opportunity to oppose some of these ideas, and that's why it takes longer. And of course, this, the current government's criticised now for not taking enough time in consultation. So, I mean, it's got to go both ways. So that's because the Resource Management Act's another one of your babies, and you want to ditch that as quick as possible. But do you believe in consultation on a piece of legislation or massive changes if you're going to build tram tracks or whatever?
Look, yeah, I mean, first of all, on legislation, I mean, you know, we've had the Resource Management Act since 1991, so, you know, it's now 28 years old. old. It's been reformed 19 times. It's gone in that period from being about 400 pages to about 900 pages. So there'll be lots of consultation. It's just problems. It's got worse. In terms of individual projects, yeah. I mean, often consultation is done terribly.
Yeah.
And people kind of find out about it after the fact. So there's an opportunity to do better consultation, but there's also an opportunity to focus. What are the things that are of public interest? And for me, that is direct effects on your property. So, you know, as a local MP, I've got people with five-story buildings up against their back fence looking into their backyard, and they've got very little say over that because they're on a zoning boundary. On the other hand, when it comes to building a house in the middle of nowhere, it takes longer to get consent to do it than it does to actually build it. And so, you know, the balance is all wrong. We've got not enough protection for direct effects on your property and too many restrictions on what you can do on your property when you're not harming anyone.
Let's drill down on your views with that. So what you're really saying is that consultation should be refined down to only those closely affected. I mean, once I was building a house and somebody in five suburbs away protested about it.
All right, what sort of house was it?
It was a three-story place, but I mean, they had no interest in it at all, but they did a protest. Mm. But that's what goes on today, and it held the thing up, and it caused all sorts of difficulties for me.
Well, a classic case. I mean, one of my constituents got two totara trees in his front yard. They're actually breaking his sewer pipes. There's you know, feces on the footpath. Where school kids walk past.
Yeah.
And, you know, people that live over 100 metres away are objecting to him cutting these trees. It's just nuts. Now, the interesting thing is, if any normal business was creating that sort of health and safety issue that this guy has been, not his own fault, there'd be a major investigation. They'd probably get whacked for it. This guy's been put in that position by the council process. And even with the local councillor and the local MP, it's almost impossible to get them to move. That's the laws that we've created. So he's not allowed to have control over his own property, but other people from far away have rights over
his property. Isn't that wrong? That's so wrong.
Yep.
Brutally wrong. Look, we've only got a few minutes left, David, but I'll tell you what, one thing, it's one of my babies here, I'm very interested in, is the National Party's policy, where it's exploring fining parents for their children leaving, well, dropping out of school, if you like, before the age of 18. Mm. Now, what they're saying is, I believe, two things. They would like them to either be further in their education, or I would suggest it's probably getting into a trade or training of some sort.
Mm.
But what's your thoughts about parents being held accountable for their children at that age?
Look, I just think, first of all, in fairness to my National Party brethren, this is not their policy. If you read the Herald article this morning, it says the Herald understands. Now, that's code for somebody left it on the press gallery photocopier and we just happened to find it. So it was leaked to them. And that's why...
I'd like to explore this idea with you further, because this is a personal thing of mine. We've got a lot of young children, whatever, whose parents are not bringing them up correctly. Mm. They're neglecting them a lot.
Mm.
And we have a lot of elderly that are being neglected. Their own children aren't looking after them. Mm. What do you think about people being held accountable for their own family?
Yeah, so it's not that we don't agree there's a problem. You know, like... We agree that there is a problem with housing. Doesn't mean we think Kiwi Build's a good idea. So I think there's a huge problem with personal responsibility. I just can't understand how it is that we spend $15 billion a year on education, and yet we have about 20% of kids coming out, according to the OECD standards, functionally illiterate and innumerate. It's a disaster. And actually a lot of policies around education. You know, we're responsible for charter schools. Our student education account would go further and put parents in charge of their kids' share of the education funding. $250,000 spent on your kids' education, you don't get control. We'd say you can take it to a private school if you want. And imagine the innovation that would spring up to capture those dollars if parents had that kind of control. So there's things that we'd like to do about this. Similarly with welfare. You know, at the moment, there's no real limits. In the hardest cases, people just stay on forever. We say if your partner beats you up or leaves you and you need to go out and look after your baby, then, you know, sole parent support or the old DPB, that'll be there for you. But if you keep having kids while you're on a benefit, then we'll put you onto electronic or cashless welfare that's worked well in New South Wales. And why? Well, because at the moment, 1 in 8 kids are born by someone on a benefit. It's outrageous. Similarly, you know, unemployment benefit or job seeker support, as it's called now, you know, we'll give everyone 4 years of that in cash because that could happen. You have a bad run of luck. That could happen throughout your life. But if you're on job seeker support for more than 4 years in your lifetime, then we'll make it electronic. And what you do by that is you ensure that people have a card so they can buy the things their kids need, not the things that they want. So we've thought about a lot about this, and we've got these policies. But what the Nats are sort of not proposing, but has been leaked by someone in there that doesn't like it, I suspect. So you're going to fine parents $3,000 if their kids are not in employment, education, or training. Okay. So here's the picture. You're from rural Northland or you're from the East Cape. Your school's been a war zone under commission management run by the government hopelessly. Your chance for higher education is a polytech that was also badly run, now being reformed into who knows what by Chris Hipkins. Your kid's gone off the rails. It's just a huge battle. Then the government comes along and says $3,000, please.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the thing. If you pay that, and they won't, it'll just be a new category of unpaid fine. What are you supposed to do after you've paid the fine? How are you actually going to get the kid engaged in doing something useful? Because if you've got the answer to that question, then maybe you didn't need to do the $3,000 fine. And that's the real issue.
Well, my question really is, and we've got to wrap up, but my real question was personal responsibility. Should people should be held accountable for their own family?
Yeah,
I'm talking about the elderly, I'm talking about their children, I'm talking about their spouse and those sort of things. If they go off the rails, should the parent or the guardians or the rest of the family be held accountable? Because I'm thinking that's where they're touching on.
Well, it's an interesting concept. Maybe they picked it up visiting China. But it's kind of like the beatings will continue until morale improves. So, you know, many of the people in these circumstances won't be able to pay. So it'll become a new category of unpaid fine.
Yeah, that's true.
And secondly, you know, after let's say they do pay the fine, what happens next? So I just think you've got to be a lot smarter, start a lot earlier, offer much better education options, have incentives in the welfare system that start, you know, from birth rather than wait until the kid's 17.
Yeah.
And I think that there's things that can be done in those areas, but you know, this is not really a policy, and I suspect that that's not their policy and never will be. Somebody thought it up, and then someone else within the National Party leaked it because they said, look, if you're going to come up with dumb policies I don't like, then we're going to leak it.
Well, we've got an election coming up next year. It's going to be an exciting time. I visualise ACT's going to do very well this election. You've really gained some traction this year. So, David, good luck for that. And I'd be interested to interview you some more of these podcasts because you get the insight in terms of the man, and I think it's important for us.
Yeah, well, I hope so. You're a very good interviewer. So,
okay. Well, I also got to thank Podcast New Zealand for their help with putting this together. But thanks again, David. And look, next week, hopefully we've got I already know there's a very interesting guest coming along. So I won't leak it now, but look forward to next Thursday. Tune in and we'll have some more good, interesting information.
Fantastic.